So many of our brave men and women who protect us every day suffer in silence from a variety of different things. PTSD, which we're going to explain, stress, and other things. But it doesn't have to be that way. There are many resources out there for you. All you have to do is take that first step. My next guest, Michael Sugru, was there. He suffered in silence for many years until he reached out and asked for help. Michael is an Air Force veteran where he served many years with honor and distinction. And after his Air Force career, he was immediately hired by the Walnut Creek Police Department where he served again for many years in a variety of roles. Michael was awarded the Walnut Creek PD Distinguished Service Medal in 2014 for his heroic and life-saving actions during a fatal officer-involved shooting in 2012. Michael ultimately retired in 2018. He is now a peer volunteer at the West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat and an ambassador for Save a Warrior. You do not want to miss this informative interview with Michael Sugru, a former Leo giving so much back to the brave men and women who protect us every day. Michael Sugru, next on the CJ Evolution Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in. We know you got many options, but thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. That's why we continue to grow. That's why we're the top-ranked CJ Evolution podcast, because of you. Thank you so much. And if you love the content, if you love the show, which I know you do, head over to Apple Podcasts, give us that 5-star rating and review. We sure would appreciate it. And share this show with your friends and family. And lastly, follow us on Facebook at Criminal Justice Evolution. A big shout out to all the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field, whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for doing it. Very difficult times right now. That's an understatement, but you put on the uniform, you go out there every day, and you put it all on the line. Remember, do not believe some of the BS you are hearing. The majority of people support you. Remember that. You remember you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Be safe, come home to your family and friends, and stay strong. Folks, if you love coffee, and you know what I'm going to say, you're going to love the products from Four Sigmatic. Everything from coffees to elixirs, you're going to love it all. My personal favorite, the Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. You are going to love it, and it doesn't taste like mushrooms. I think it tastes better than regular coffee. It gives me that energy, clarity, zip to get me through the day. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see the link to Four Sigmatic. Trust me, you will not be disappointed. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. Enjoy.
This is a national healthcare alert from the 24/7 Diabetic Health Hotline. If you, a family member, or a loved one has diabetes, listen closely. Now, regardless of your age, if you have insurance, you may qualify to receive diabetic testing supplies with little to no out-of-pocket cost. Get free delivery, free information, and all the paperwork is handled by our accredited suppliers for free. Call the 24/7 Diabetic Health Hotline now for details. Toll free at this number. But wait, there's more. If you call right now, you could get a meter upgrade. In addition, we'll give you a free pair of diabetic socks as our special gift to you. Regardless of your age, if you suffer with diabetes and have insurance, you may qualify to get free delivery of your supplies.
800-443-1549. 800-443-1549. 800-443-1549. That's 800-443-1549.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything.
800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. That's 800-210-7907.
It is such an honor to be partnered with a great company like Detecticam. If you've never heard of this company, you need to. You need it for the sake and safety of your troops. They are providing our brave men and women who protect us every day with mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of their hands. This app-based technology detects everything from COVID-19 to illicit drugs to explosives. Folks, you got to have this technology for your troops. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Detecticam. See how they can help keep your troops safer. On to this amazing show with the one and only Michael Sugru. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on the show, Michael Sugru. And Michael is dedicated advocate for awareness, prevention, education, training on post-traumatic stress injury, which we're going to talk about it, and first responder suicide prevention. He continues to speak all around the country to law enforcement agencies everywhere. Michael, are you there, sir?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being on the show, brother. And you had a good career in law enforcement, served admirably, if I could talk. And you also served in the United States Air Force. And I always like asking Leos and former military, why did you choose the path of law enforcement in the military, brother? What was the catalyst behind that?
Actually, it goes all the way back to childhood. My stepfather who raised me, he was a police lieutenant here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And at a very young age, I think about 8 years old, I was actually a police volunteer for his first department, Sausalito PD. And then after that, I went into the Explorer program at Richmond PD. So I've just always had a passion and felt a calling. And I owe it to my father. I looked up to him. He was my hero. And I aspired to be like him. So I really think it's because of his mentorship and what he taught me.
Mm-hmm. And you held many different positions the police department. Patrol officer, driving training instructor, field training officer. I mean, you did it all, brother. You wanted every experience you could get your hand on, right?
I did. Yeah, I was undercover for a couple of years, also on a state drug task force. And, I actually planned on making it a full 30-plus year career and had many more aspirations. But things happen and things change, and now I'm here today doing something different.
Yeah, much needed work. Now you, again, talk to a lot of officers around the country. Why is it so hard for Leo's law enforcement to talk about the things that they are struggling with? Because I struggled with a lot of things, during my career, but for many years it was very hard for me to open up and tell people that I was struggling. I mean, what are you hearing? Why do you think it's so hard for Leos everywhere to kind of bring this stuff to the surface?
There's actually, I think, a couple of different reasons, and obviously it varies with different people, and sometimes mm-hmm. it's a combination. A lot of Leos don't want to hear this, but a lot of things go back to actual childhood, and a lot of first responders, and I say that as a whole, so I mean firefighters, mm-hmm. police officers, paramedics, dispatchers, a lot of times they have some childhood trauma. And what I mean by that is they might possibly have alcoholic relatives or parents, maybe emotionally distant parents, might have been abused, whether that be physically or sexually. But at an early age, a lot of us learn to be caretakers and to fix things and solve problems, to not show emotion, to not show we're scared. And we kind of just bring that through us through our childhood and eventually into adulthood. Mm-hmm. And so there's just this, and I hate to say it, but, when you're talking male and female, just the way that we're raised also, I think, has an influence. I'm a father, I have a young daughter, and, boys from an early start are taught to tough it up and not cry and not show fear, not show emotion. Yet young girls, it's okay to show emotion. And so, I think that's the actual foundation of it, but I think more applicable is the actual culture within the military, within being a first responder. And it starts with the training process. I mean, mm-hmm. all the way at the police academy and indoctrination. And, you're taught to be tough. You're taught not to quit. You're taught not to show emotion, that you have to go into these most dangerous and violent situations and show no fear and absolutely take charge. And so that's ingrained from you. And I think that's important because I think you have to have that aspect of almost invincibility mm-hmm. to where you can run into danger. I mean, you take like an active shooter situation, which is probably the most dangerous situation an LEO can face. And it's an active situation where people are probably getting shot, getting killed. And we have to run in there as quick as we can and neutralize that threat, knowing that there's a good chance we may be killed. Mm-hmm. And so you have this one side where, you almost have to be this superhuman being. And I think the other side of it as well is that as first responders, we're exposed to just so much trauma day in and day out. And literally, we're going from call to call to call to call. I mean, you may take a single day and you may have multiple critical incidents in one single day. And those are different for everybody. Yeah. But, you know, just the typical calls that we face, suicides, domestic violence, child abuse, sudden deaths, fatal car accidents, even just natural deaths. I mean, all those things take a toll. And when we go to these calls, you know, we're being exposed to witnesses, to family members, to other officers. And our job is to go there, to maintain order, to find out the facts, to investigate what's going on, and to not get emotional while we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's almost a self-protection thing that we do and a shield that we put up, you know, to say that this stuff doesn't affect us.
Yeah.
But in reality, it actually is affecting us. And it's just piling up and piling up and piling up. And on a conservative estimate, a typical first responder over a full 30-year career is exposed to a minimum of 500 traumatic or critical incidents. And that's a conservative estimate, 500, whereas the general public, they may be exposed
one or two.
Yeah, in their whole lifetime. Yeah. I mean, if that.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, you hit it, Michael. I mean, I did it for a long time. I know you did. But you're exactly right. We're not designed as human beings to see chaos and suffering and then be cool with it and be functioning, you know, where we should be. I know because I was one of those people. I mean, I've seen, you know, like you, you know, traumatic human suffering throughout a career, and it did affect me. So for the listener out there who thinks that you're just bulletproof, using that term, you know, as far as mentally, that you're going to be able to, you know, somehow weather the storm without this stuff bubbling up later on in the future, it's not going to happen. I mean, you need to reach out and ask for help, right?
Absolutely. And I firmly believe that if you address these things as they're happening, and obviously not in the immediate call or on scene, but after you've left the call or when things have slowed down, and if something bothered you, you need to talk to somebody about it. You need to share that. And that doesn't mean necessarily running to a therapist or to a doctor. I'm talking about simply just talking to your peers mm-hmm. or to your beat partners and just being real and sharing, like, hey, you know, like that infant death that we just went to, that really took a toll on me, and explain why and just express your feelings. And I think if you do that, you know, you can go a full career and you can maintain your mental health and your physical health. For me, I didn't do that. And I let it just bottle up yeah. until it just overflowed and it was too much.
Yeah. And I don't think, just in my personal opinion, I don't think the fact that we live, there's no doubt we live in some just unbelievable time right now, Michael, with this, I'm just going to call it an assault and or war, whatever you want to call it, on police officers. And I don't think it helps police officers that are serving us every day bravely and honorably to see certain media outlets or some politicians just bash on them all the time. So that's almost like a double whammy. Not only do they see all this suffering, now they got people, prominent people, in a lot of cases, just bashing the hell out of them. And that just takes a toll on them.
Absolutely. I know fellow officers who right now today are being prosecuted for actions that saved lives. And they're being put out there in the media by the politicians, now district attorneys, politicians, and they're being made examples when they did everything right. And so you already have an issue where officers and first responders, they're scared to ask for help and they're not sure if they have the support. And this is before what's happening right now. And now to add on top of that, you have these officers who feel like they're being abandoned from all sides. I mean, by their city, by their agencies, you know, by their DAs, and they feel like they have nowhere to go. And so I think given what's going on in the world and the sentiment against law enforcement right now, it's making things much worse. And because of that, our suicide numbers are going to skyrocket.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up suicide. I think 228 officers, I think that statistic is right, in 2019 alone committed suicide. And I hope and pray that those numbers are down in 2020, but with the current environment, who knows?
Well, I just checked today and we're up to 125 officially reported suicides. And even that number is conservative and underreported. But the simple facts are this. As a first responder, and again, I mean, police officers, paramedics, firefighters, dispatchers, you are much more likely to die at your own hands than the hands of another. And that is a fact.
Yeah, I just never thought we would be. And I don't know if you saw those kids, you know, football players. I think it was somewhere in the Midwest, Ohio. I don't know for sure. But they come out to the field and they're waving. One has a thin red line and the one has a thin blue line because their dads are once in the fire agency or fire department, the other one's in the PD. And they initially suspended these kids. I don't know if you saw that. And then they kind of rescinded the principle. But I never thought, brother, we would be in a culture, in a society where we're actually that's offensive. You know what I mean? And that has got to play on the psyche and you know, the morale of police officers and other first responders. It's not just police officers, like you said, it's all first responders. It's just unbelievable. I never thought we'd be in an era like we are now.
I did see that story and it completely outraged me. And, you know, the simple fact is this: a lot of first responders, especially law enforcement officers right now, they can't share the fact out in the public that they're affiliated with law enforcement. They can't express their views or their freedom of speech because they're in fear of losing their jobs. And so you have these people who were like myself, who were so proud to serve my community, so proud to be a law enforcement officer. And now it's almost like these officers, when they're off duty, have to hide the fact that they work in law enforcement because they're scared that people are going to follow them back to their house, that they or their family are going to be attacked. I mean, not only do they have the fear and danger while they're working, but now they have to worry about it when they're off duty. And so the stress and the pressure is just through the roof.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And I know we were talking about before we started, and I saw you in an interview. And again, we talked about it before we started, but you don't like calling it post-traumatic stress disorder. You call it post-traumatic stress injury. Can you explain it? And I agree with you. I said that in the opening, but I really like that instead of calling it a disorder.
Absolutely. You know, the official term for the psychologists and the therapists and the DSM is post-traumatic stress disorder. What I'm trying to do is to help get that changed to post-traumatic stress injury. And the reason is this: the word disorder by itself, that prevents people from asking for help. There's a stigma behind the word disorder. And not only that, it's not a disorder, it's an actual injury. And there's been numerous studies that have shown there are actual physical effects and physical changes to the human brain as a result of prolonged or repeated exposure to traumatic incidents. I mean, it's a fact. And so what I'm trying to do is change that, because like you said, just that word disorder, it's going to prevent people from raising their hand up and saying, I need help. I mean, let's look at law enforcement officers or firefighters. How many of them have shoulder injuries or back injuries or knee injuries? And they have no problem raising their hand saying, hey, my shoulder, it's injured. I want to get better. I need help. Well, the same thing applies to PTSI. You can get better. There is treatment. There is help. And you can recover. And so that's why it's so important to change that stigma. And I call it smashing the stigma. And we start by doing that by calling it post-traumatic stress injury.
Yeah, it's such a great example that you use, because, I mean, it's amazing how one word, you know, and I never thought about it for a long time, but disorder. Yeah. I mean, there's so much of a stigma behind it. Oh, I can't say anything because I'm effed up. I mean, I have a disorder, you know, but just a simple change of a word could mean literally life or death from somebody reaching out or somebody just living in silence and suffering.
Absolutely. And it's just simply changing the stigma, changing the culture, and addressing it for what it is, which is an injury.
So what do you think, Michael? You know, obviously everybody within an organization, whatever you're doing in the first responder community, is a part of this, but what can police supervisors, high ranking, you know, brass, you know, command staff, whatever you want to call them, what can they do to help combat this problem? Because in a lot of ways, you know, brother, you've done it. You know, it has to, well, not all the time, but it generally is going to start from the top and kind of go down. And I got to tell you, in my experience, you know, some, you know, senior executives in law enforcement, they understand, they're with it, you know, but others don't give a shit, it seems like.
It does absolutely start at the top, and it starts with leadership. Mm-hmm. I've had some frank discussions with some police chiefs, and there's one in particular here in Northern California that I met with, and he was very transparent, very pro mental health, very pro addressing the stigma. And he shared an actual story with me, and I later met this lieutenant. And this is a perfect example of how easy it is to do this. So this particular department had a department-wide training for peer support. And most departments have peer support teams. We have the training. It's usually pretty boring. It's more educational. It's not personal. But in this instance, this lieutenant, and it wasn't planned, he's just decided during this entire department training that he was going to share his personal experience and personal struggles with PTSI.
Wow.
And he kept it very real. He opened himself up fully in front of this entire room. 99% of those officers had no idea this lieutenant had suffered, had gone through this. And just that's just one simple example. But that's how you normalize it. That's how you show, especially these younger law enforcement officers that are coming in that haven't experienced all this trauma yet, that this is normal. It is okay, and that we can talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I think if you do that at all the levels, you know, I was a patrol sergeant and I had a patrol team. And so we would have lineup every single day before we went out to the streets. And usually we'd have a half hour. And that's a perfect example, a perfect venue when it's warranted or it's necessary to open up those conversations. You know, maybe the day before, half the patrol team went to a particularly heinous call. And so you just bring it out and start talking about it. And it's that simple. It's talking about it. It's changing the stigma. It's creating a culture where it's okay to talk about these things.
Yeah. What's the power of humility? You know, being genuine, like you said. And I think for, because I did it for over two decades. And I know that in some people's eyes, you know, when you start talking about personal stuff and you're exposing yourself, a lot of people think, well, it's a sign of weakness. I disagree. It's a sign of strength. You know, and so humility is huge, you know, and if you can expose yourself and bring in your personal examples, like you said, especially with a younger generation, I think it makes you that much more stronger as a leader.
It does. And for me, you know, that shame and that stigma, it prevented me for 4 years.
Oh, me too.
For asking for help. And you're right, because that was the hardest and most courageous thing I ever did was asking for help. It wasn't for any of the calls or any of the incidents I was involved in, whether it be the military or law enforcement, it was raising my hand up and asking for help. But even when I did that, for over a year and a half, I didn't tell anybody that I knew what I was going through or why I was off work or ashamed. Mm-hmm. And that's how powerful that shame is. It prevented me from opening up and sharing what I went through. And so that's what I do now, is it took me a lot of work to get here. But I want to show people that I'm not special, I'm not unique, and that I suffer just like many of them are suffering, and that they're not alone. That's what they need to know, is they're simply not alone.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, when you started exposing yourself and coming out and asking for help and saying you were struggling, did you get mocked? Did people say, well, Michael, we can't back him up, he's weak? I mean, because I went through a little bit of, through that.
And it's really uncomfortable, and it's really unfortunate, but I think those are probably the ones that are suffering the most.
Yeah.
But the vast majority, when they finally figured out what I was going through, what I was experiencing, I mean, the outreach was phenomenal, the messages, the emails. But on the flip side of that, and I have to be honest with you, a big part of this is administrative betrayal.
Yeah.
And I had one captain in particular who, from the beginning of my treatment and trying to get better, he tried to get rid of me and tried to talk me into retiring. And my whole plan from the beginning was to go back to work. And that one single person had a huge negative impact on me and on my recovery, but also from initially asking for help. And that's why I hope if any supervisors, any administrators are listening to this, you as one single person can make or break not only someone's recovery, but you could cost them their life.
Mm-hmm. And for those supervisors out there, I'll just piggyback on what you say. I mean, for the people that are, and again, I know it's easier said than done leaving an organization, but do you really want to work for an organization that supervisors and the brass are not supporting you and they're not, you know, giving you the help that you need to recover? You know, Michael, people aren't flocking to law enforcement anymore. So if our brave men and women are suffering, they're going through problems, we need to do our best to keep them and get the treatment they need, because we're not getting the ranks replenished anymore. You know what I mean? I mean, people aren't flocking to law enforcement anymore, and we need to be taking care of our troops anyway, better than we are.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of city managers, mayors, police chiefs, they give lip service to, we take care of our people, you know, mm-hmm. we're family. Well, the thing is, you have to actually do that. You can't just say you do it. You have to mean it, and you have to do it every single day. And your people will know it. The culture will know it. And those are the people that will feel comfortable asking for help. Unfortunately, the ones who won't ask for help, they're in agencies where that is not the culture. It's not acceptable. It's looked upon as being weak. And you're right. There's an epidemic shortage of law enforcement officers, and officers are retiring in record numbers. I mean, record numbers.
Yeah. I don't think I know a cop out there, Michael, that is not looking for an exit ramp, you know, it's not looking for a way out. And it's sad because a lot of good people are going to leave because, you know, it's the environment. It's not just brass not taking care of them. It's a culmination. You know that, but that's a part of it too.
Absolutely. And what most of the general public doesn't realize is that most law enforcement officers and first responders as a whole, it's a calling. This is something that they've wanted to do for a lot of times their entire life. And they truly are dedicated to helping others and making a difference. This isn't some job they saw on Craigslist with good benefits and they said, let me check that out and try it out. Yeah, that happens. But the vast majority of first responders, they do it because they're dedicated to helping others.
Yeah.
And when that disappears and people just start signing up for a job, that's going to have real drastic effects on our communities as a whole.
Well, we're seeing it now. I mean, the whole defund the police, and I had another guest on earlier, you know, about New York City lost $1 billion. You know, they took $1 billion out of their budget. There's going to be some ripple effects to that. Michael, can you talk about West Coast post-trauma retreat, and also Save a Warrior?
I sure can. Both are phenomenal programs, and both programs I personally went through. I'll talk about the West Coast post-trauma retreat first, because I went through that first. Mm-hmm. I went through as a client in May of 2017, and it's a week-long retreat. This one is only open to first responders. It's not for military per se, but you can be a veteran, but you have to be either a current or former first responder. So it's open to dispatchers, paramedics, firefighters, and police officers. And basically, you go through as a client, there's a group of six. Usually it's a mixture of fire and law enforcement. And the vast majority is peers. And the peers volunteer a week at a time. They've actually been through the program themselves, like I have, and I now go back and volunteer. And again, mix of fire and law enforcement. And then you also have chaplains, therapists, and clinicians who give up their private practice for a full week, and they come out and volunteer at this retreat. And it's hard to explain what happens. I mean, a lot of people say it's magic, and literally I've seen it personally where the transformation of people in just a matter of a couple of days, I've seen grown men and women who have had things bottled up their entire life, who have never shared it with anybody, that within a couple of days had the strength and courage to share their most deepest and darkest personal experiences in a room with 30 people they literally met a couple days before. I mean,
wow.
It's
powerful.
It's almost indescribable because you have to experience it. I mean, it is just an amazing, amazing program. Again, the West Coast post-trauma retreat. I highly encourage any first responders out there to just Google that, look into the program. It started out here in California, but now they have locations I believe, in Oregon, Arizona, Washington, also out in the Midwest, and they're expanding. And it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal program. The second one I went through, and this one I literally just went through last month in August. And this one is open to active military, veterans, but also first responders. Again, this one is a week-long retreat. It's more of an experience. And it is open to men and women, but it's not co-ed. West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat is co-ed when you go through it, but Save a Warrior is not. And there's reasons for that. But again, this is a phenomenal program. This one is more focused on complex PTS. And what I mean by that complex is that you have the childhood trauma, but then you also have the work-related trauma or the moral injury. And those oftentimes get stacked on top of one another. And you really have to address both. You can't just address one without the other. Mm-hmm. And so this program, even after being in recovery myself for a couple years and going to therapy and volunteering and speaking and first responder support meetings, this program, Save a Warrior, gave me a piece that I didn't even realize I was missing. And it was, again, absolutely life-changing for me. But here's the beauty of this program. Save a Warrior does not cost anything for the person to go through. It is funded by donations 100%. So there is zero cost for anyone listening to go through Save a Warrior. They have a location in Southern California and Ohio, and all you have to do is physically get yourself there. The last thing I want to add is that for Save a Warrior, you simply just Google the name, you go to their website, it takes less than 5 minutes to apply, and at some point they'll schedule you a rostering phone call with somebody that works with Save a Warrior. And you may or may not be a good fit, but that's what that phone call is for.
Yeah.
And these programs are life-changing, but more importantly, life-saving. I can't speak enough about them.
Yeah, and they're going to be linked up in the show notes. Michael, any final thoughts, brother, before we take off?
You know, the simple thought is this, is that I waited far too long to ask for help, and it almost cost me my life in more than one way. And so I encourage anybody listening to this, if you're suffering in silence, please, please raise your hand and ask for help. There are so many resources and options available to get help, to recover from this injury.
Michael Sugru, thank you so much, brother, for your service to this great country, your dedicated and honorable service in law enforcement. Thank you for coming on with your expertise, providing great information, and anything we can do for you, sir, with the show to bring more awareness to what you're doing. Please, please let me know. And thank you for coming on.
It was my honor. Thank you for having me.
All right, brother. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.